Good morning. Wow, you're all here. It's a beautiful day out there, you know. Okay, you made your choice. Well, welcome to Zen Center, for those of you who are new, and welcome to Zen Center for those of you who are not new. This morning is Joyce Food Shelf Donation Sunday. Did everybody know that? It's Joyce Food Shelf Donation Sunday today. And so all of the collection money that we take up today is going to be donated to the Joyce Food Shelf. And so that makes it a day of giving here at MZMC. And so I'm going to talk about giving. I'm going to talk about the three types of gifts that are discussed in traditional Buddhist texts, the Pali texts. So you have on your program today a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh that I'll refer to later, and a cartoon that I will refer to later. And if you don't have one of those, you can just look on with your neighbor. So the three types of gifts that are mentioned in early Buddhist texts are the gift of material things, the gift of fearlessness, and the gift of Dharma. The gift of material things, the gift of fearlessness, and the gift of Dharma. These are sometimes translated in different ways, and they're certainly talked about in many, many different ways. We could actually do, I think, easily an entire 8-week practice period just exploring the way Buddhism has talked about and practiced giving in the last 2,500 years. It's actually something they put a lot of emphasis on, and it's much more nuanced than we first take it to be. So I'm just going to skate a little bit along the surface today because we have limited time. But those are the three things that were talked about, and what I want to do is talk a little bit about each of them. I want to talk a little bit about how they've shown up in my life, just sort of pick an example of how I've experienced receiving these gifts, and I want to talk a little bit about how we might offer the three of these. So does that sound good? It's the talk I prepared, so you're stuck. I'm just trying to get you on board here. So we'll start at the beginning, the gift of material things. This is an easy one to start with. We all understand this. The Sanskrit is amisa dana. Dana was a word we still use a lot around here, usually translated as giving or generosity, offering. The bowl we're going to pass around later is called the dana bowl, the offering bowl, the generosity bowl. So amisa dana is the gift of material things. And the reason I say we're familiar with this is because this is the way we normally think of giving. It's the gift of food, the gift of medicine, the gift of shelter, the gift of money, the gift of clothing, right? It's generally thought of as tangible material things. And this was emphasized in early Buddhism in the form of they actually put a huge amount of emphasis on this in early Buddhism, but the example that comes to mind to me that I actually really like, and I didn't hear this for many years after I had started studying, and I wish I had heard it early. But when the Buddha would send his nuns and monks out to a new village off for several days, weeks, even months, off on their mendicant rounds, he would say, when you come to a new village, if they do not have food, help them to get food. If they do not have medicine, help them to get medicine. If they do not have clothing or shelter, help them to get clothing or shelter. And if they have food, and they have clothing, and they have shelter, and they have medicine, then, and only then, should you offer them the gift of Dharma, the gift of teaching, the gift of the Buddhist path, right? I really like that. I really like it because you'd sort of think, well, this is my mission, this is the thing I want to offer, the Dharma, so get out there and offer it. And that's included, but I loved the idea of check in with who you are offering this to. Because if they don't have enough food to eat, there is no time for Dharma. The Dharma shows up as you helping them to get food to eat, helping them to irrigate. There's stories about nuns and monks going to villages, and they just ended up spending months with the villagers, irrigating the land so they could plant crops. That was their gift of the Dharma. And they would never have had to talk about interdependence and emptiness and suffering and the Four Noble Truths. So in the West, we understand this to be, we all know this because this is Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Right, we totally get that. I can't be receptive to high spiritual teaching if I'm hungry and I don't have a place to live. And I'm sick and I don't have medicine. Right? So it's kind of common sense stuff. But it's really, really cool that the tradition of that material giving goes all the way back and was prioritized over the gift of Dharma, at least in some settings. It kind of makes sense. It kind of makes sense. So I really like that. So Maslow's hierarchy, of course, starts with food, and then we work our way toward shelter, clothing, medicine, things like that. And this, of course, makes sense without physical nourishment. Nothing else can matter to us. So my example in my own life of how I've received a misa dana, the gift of material things, of course, there's an infinite number of examples, but one that's especially pertinent this morning, because this is Joyce Food Shelf Sunday, is when I used to live not too far from here, in the Stevens Square neighborhood of South Minneapolis. I used the food shelf and EBT, food stamps. The food shelf was at Plymouth Congregational Church. I don't know if it still is. Maybe it still is. But that was a lifeline for me during a time when I was struggling quite a bit. And so what I remember about it was going there every week, and all I needed to show them was an ID and a piece of mail, is what I remember anyway. A piece of mail that would tie me to that address. Like, yep, you actually do live there. Right, okay, cool. Bring your electric bill or something. And then I'd stand in line, and 10 minutes later or whatever, I'd walk out of that building with a grocery bag full of, you know, usually mostly food, but sometimes other stuff. Soap, toilet paper, shampoo, whatever they happened to have that week that I needed. And my favorite part of this memory, what I remember, is on the weeks when we got cheese, the bag was really heavy because they give you a big brick of government cheese. And it was actually labeled in like the most terrifically unappetizing way you could possibly label anything you're going to put in your body, but it actually had like the stamp and the whole like government, actually, you know, some variation on government issued cheese. It doesn't sound appetizing. I never see that on a menu, ever. Would you like to pay extra for the government cheese? Yes, they're famous for good dairy. Anyway, it was a big brick. So on the days when I would leave the food shelf with that brick of cheese, I remember feeling secure. I felt safe. I don't know that I would have been aware that that's how I felt at that time, but that's how I felt. Because, you know, a loaf of bread and a brick of cheese is a lot of food. It's actually a lot of food. So that always made me feel safe. And hungry, actually, because I'd always make a grilled cheese sandwich when I got home, duh. Right? So, an idea I have today for how we might all offer material things is, of course, we're being handed an opportunity, a very easy opportunity today from Zen Center because of our partnership with the food shelf. One way you can offer a misa dana is putting some money in the bowl today when it goes around. So for Joyce Food Shelf, $1 is 3 meals. I have no idea how they do that. That seems like a miracle to me, that they can somehow translate $1 into 3 meals. I can't. If I get 1 meal for less than $10, I'm like, all right, I'm a bandit if I can manage that. But they do that. So if I put a $20 bill in the Dana Bowl, that's 60 meals, 20 days of food. but I actually have I'll call it a challenge, a request, an idea maybe for you today. And that is, please don't put anything in the bowl today, if you're doing it out of pity. Please don't put anything in the bowl today if you're doing it because you want to feel above or you want to feel like a good person. You want to kind of get that warm, sticky smugness we get. Please don't do it if you're trying to separate yourself from a person or from an experience the reality of what hunger is, then please don't do it. But please do put something in the bowl if you can feel some genuine connection, some genuine empathy, some genuine compassion for the experience of the people in this neighborhood who are hungry. Because you have been hungry. Everybody on the planet has been hungry. And maybe you haven't been hungry for a day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days at a time. Maybe you have. I don't know. But everybody knows how sharp that sensation is. Right? How demanding it is. How much of our experience it eclipses. Does that make sense? We're going back to this early Buddhist idea of like, how receptive are you to the Dharma of non-duality when you haven't eaten in 2 days? You're not receptive to the Dharma of non-duality at all. We know how these basic universal human needs affect our experience. And this is one of the ways we get to connect with every other human on the planet. This is how suffering gets to connect us. Wow, I'm really hungry. Wow, 6 billion other people on the planet either are having or have had this very same experience. I can therefore offer this. I am connected to them through this experience, right? We all have that when our hearts get broken, when we get angry, when we feel lonely. These are universal human experiences. And instead of making them mine, I can use them as an opportunity to remind me of how connected I am to everybody. When I give a $20 bill to the Donable out of that spirit, something wonderful is happening in me. Right? This becomes a healing moment for me. Does that make sense in a way? I know that's a little weird, but it makes sense to me. The reason this is on my radar is because I look back on my history and I realize most of the gifts I have given materially, the money I've given to the charity or to the person on the side of the street or to whatever that thing is, was really about, I want this thing to go away. I don't want to see it. I don't want to feel it. I want to distance myself. I send a check to whatever it is, or I give a $5 bill to whoever it is, and I drive away feeling, whew, that's taken care of. And, you know, if I'm really honest, I feel a little smug. God, I'm a good person. I'm just a good person. Right? So I've just met my own ego need, and I haven't done a bad thing. I'm not trying to beat myself up about it. That isn't the point. The point is for me to have awareness that goes all the way down to the bottom of what's actually motivating me. Was my motivation in those moments to be connected to the universality of human suffering? No, it was not. My motivation was to try to shut that down and not feel it, not see it, and feel even maybe a little of, that's never going to happen to me. That's how we distance ourselves. Right? And Buddhism is not about distancing ourselves from suffering. It's about getting closer and closer and closer to it until we can transform it. Right? We welcome it in. We turn toward it. I know it's counterintuitive, but that is what we do. So stuff like putting money in an offering bowl is a great opportunity for the ego, and it's also a great opportunity for practice to see through that and go, oh, I know why I'm doing this. I get all the layers. All right? That makes sense to me. And also, I know this is also a universal experience. I know every person in this room has had the experience of being pitied. Isn't it like the worst thing? Isn't it just terrible? Even if somebody says all the right stuff, somehow you walk away going, God, like what just happened there? I feel like I need a shower. There's something gross about that. You've just used me as a step stool. Now you feel better. In order to, you know, you just put me down in order to put yourself up. There's something about that we don't like. I don't like it. So when the bowl comes around, you have an opportunity for practice today. That was my gift to you, an opportunity for practice. Okay. The second one, Abhaya Dana. In the Sanskrit, Abhaya Dana. This is the gift of fearlessness. It's also, one of the other translations I found, which I thought was interesting, was the gift of life. But that's a whole other Dharma talk, because to equate fearlessness with life is a fascinating idea. That's just in my own noodle. But we're going to stick with fearlessness today. The gift of fearlessness. This is an interesting idea. That's the one that sticks in my imagination. I heard about this many years ago. A lot of Dharma teachers have talked, especially in the Zen tradition, about the gift of fearlessness. And I like that. It's a really interesting thing to play with, what fearlessness is, how we receive it, and how we give it. So the way I'm going to talk about it, I guess, this morning is to remind us of something we already know, which is right now the world we are living in and sharing, especially in this culture and this time, is very scared. We all know this. There's a lot of fear right now. The world's always scared, of course, but right now it's just especially evident in our culture. It's in our face all the time, how scared our world is right now. Sometimes that shows up as anger, right? When we're angry, we're usually scared. So we see this in ourselves. We feel fear. We feel scared. We certainly see it in the faces and in the words of family, coworkers, friends. And that's even before we open up our computer and start looking at the news and going, oh, mama, it is out there. What a scared place this is. So we walk away from these awarenesses of fear wondering, what do I do? What can I do? I know I want to show up. I know I want to be helpful. I know how it feels to be scared. That's another universal human experience. So we ask ourselves, what's the antidote to fear? What's the antidote to fear? Fearlessness. Fearlessness. To be without fear. Hatred does not stop by hatred, but by non-hatred. Fear does not stop by fear, but by non-fear. By fearlessness. So if we want to offer, if we want to give fearlessness to a world that is scared and to ourselves who are scared, we commit ourselves to living a life of non-harm. Not hurting. Don't make things worse, Norm Fisher says. That's exactly what he's saying. Make things worse. You're scared. I offer you my fear. I have not helped you. Now we're both even more scared. I commit myself to a principle of non-harm. That, in Buddhist terms, is loving kindness, compassion, unconditional positive regard. Can you guys still hear me back there? I'm going to keep just going and we'll see what happens. So, scared of us, and we are scared of each other, when we think we can... Cool, thank you very much. Can you hear me again back there? Okay. So, people get scared of us when they feel we can hurt them. If people know you're committed to non-harm, they aren't scared of you. They don't have a reason to be scared of you anyway. You give them no reason. Part of the early Buddhist tradition of identifying monks and nuns as Buddhist monks and nuns by having them wear the robe, by having them shave their head, was this spirit. To have them be visibly and obviously committed to a path of non-harm. This was seen as, I'm offering the gift of fearlessness. When you see me in my orange robe and my shaved head, you know, oh, I'm a Buddhist nun, I'm a Buddhist monk, and I'm committed to loving kindness and compassion and non-harm. I'm not scared of you. Right? You got a robe and a bowl. You're not a threat. Those people, as they went on their rounds, offered folks the gift of non-harm by embodying non-harm. I will not harm self or other. I am safe. That's what the robe and the shaved head said. It still does. Those were, and they still are, powerful ways of offering fearlessness. But of course, there's many ways that we offer fearlessness. Buckminster Fuller, you guys know Buckminster Fuller? If you don't, Google him. He's a good character. He said, you never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. You never change things by fighting the existing reality. to change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. Right? We don't fight fear with fear. It doesn't work. You don't fight hate with hate. It doesn't work. You invent something else. A new model that makes the old one obsolete. So here's something we can all do every day that addresses our fear. Thich Nhat Hanh teaches us the first part of looking at our fear is just inviting it into our awareness without judgment. We just acknowledge gently that it's there. This brings a lot of relief already. Then, once our fear has calmed down, we can embrace it tenderly, and we can look deeply into its roots, its sources. Understanding the origins of our anxieties and fears will help us let go of them. Is our fear coming from something that is happening right now? Or is it really an old fear, a fear from when we were very small, but we've kept it inside? We practice inviting all our fears up. And if we're not pushing down and managing our fear, we can enjoy the sunshine, the fog, the air, and the water. Fearlessness is not only possible, it is the ultimate joy. When you touch non-fear, you are free. Isn't that lovely? I can't improve on that. That's the cartoon I put on your program, actually. That's all that really was. Right? Fear shows up, and the person hugs it. Hello, I see you. Hello, big monster. I see that you're there. It transforms the experience. So in this tradition, we call this Zazen. I was hoping everybody was going to join in. Zazen. Because you're all like, I know where he's going with this. Zazen. Imagine a Zen talk that pushes Zazen. Wow. So when fear shows up in our Zazen, what do? Deny it, repress it, ignore it, think of something else, review our favorite episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. No. We don't do any of those things. We go, oh, I see it. There it is. There's how it shows up in my body. My breathing just changed. My heart rate just changed. My palms just started to sweat. However that is for you. I have a tension in my shoulders, maybe. Hello, fear. I recognize you. You're here. I see how it shows up emotionally. How constricted my emotions get, too. How quick I am to want to make an enemy. How quick I am to think thoughts of violence. There's a thinking component, an emotional component, a physiological component. And in Zazen, you welcome it all in. Hello, come on in, have a seat, leave when you're ready. I'm not going to feed you, but I'm not going to turn you away either, because there are no doors to Zazen. Everything comes in and everything goes out. And it transforms our experience. So here's an example from my own life of how I experienced this. When I was a kid and I'd come running home because I'd been stung by a bee, or some such thing. If I was met at the door by, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, you've been hurt, oh my God, sit down right here, hold on a minute, how do I feel? I came home already at about a 5 or a 6, right? Because I got stung by a bee, and I'm a kid, and I'm thinking, I don't know, I'm probably going to blow up and die. Because I'm a kid, right? And I was met with, and so now I'm at about a 9. Because I'm thinking, yeah, I guess this is it. It's going to end right here in the foyer. Oh my God, I didn't think this was going to be how it was going to end, but clearly this is it. And then there were other times when I was met with, oh, sweetie, oh, sit down. You got stung? Did you get stung? Oh, come on, sit on down here. We'll fix you right up. Now my 5 is down to maybe a 4, maybe a 3. Maybe it stayed at a 5, I don't know. But the point is, nobody threw gas on that fire. My fear was not met with fear. My fear was met with fearlessness. And already, like Thich Nhat Hanh says, that brings a lot of relief. Right? We all have examples. Like, you know, when you go to your coworker, something's wrong with my computer. Do you think this is, do you have the blue screen of death? Oh, my God! Or, yeah. This kind of shows up in our experience every single day. If you're in a fear place, you're receptive to fear. You're vibrating at fear. Right? So when you're hanging out with a bunch of other people who are really scared, you're going to ratchet it up. And if you're hanging out with a bunch of other people who aren't, it's going to go down. Fearlessness. So, I also received the gift of fearlessness more recently today, this morning, from you. From everybody here in this room who sat Zazen for 40 minutes under these same beams and rafters. Did you not offer me the gift of fearlessness? That's what Zazen is. The physical embodiment of fearlessness. Hello, fear. I see you. All of us had something come up. Boredom, frustration, anger, fear, joy, contentment. Whatever. You know, the show. You sit down and just go, hello, show. You all did it. You physically committed yourself to doing it with your body expressing it. Open, receptive chest. Right? Balanced posture. Not leaning forward or back. The embodiment of fearlessness. Right? Fear looks like this. We all know what that looks like. This is how we usually sit. This is what non-fear looks like. There's something really beautiful about it. You offered that gift to the whole world, actually. Thank you on behalf of me who received it from you this morning, but you actually offered it to yourself, to the whole world. Do you think the ripples stop with you? They don't. The ripples don't stop with me. You offered it to the whole world. And another idea about how you might entertain continuing to offer this is to really think about that. That was you being a non-anxious presence. That was you being a non-anxious presence. Right? And when anxiety did show up in you, you met it with fearlessness. Hello, I see you. Right? If you're a non-anxious presence and you carry that out into the world, into the traffic, into your domestic situation, into your work situation, into a political situation, you're a non-anxious presence. In a scared world, fearlessness is the medicine. This is what we need to show up to be. Does that make sense? I mean, it really does to me, non-anxious presence. I'm not thrown by the fact that I'm scared. I'm not thrown by it. I don't have to be tossed away by it. I can deal with it as it arises in my consciousness. I don't have to say things from that place. I don't have to do things from that place. I can stop watering those seeds and I can do something else. So please offer the world your fearlessness. It needs it now. We all know that. Bearing witness to fear offers that fear a balm and an antidote. And it's bearing witness to the fear in ourselves first, bearing witness to fear in the world second. It ends up being the same thing. It actually doesn't matter. But do that. Sitting Zazen's a great way. Do that. Just sit Zazen at home. Sit Zazen at the precinct downtown if you want. Sit Zazen at the Capitol if you want. Or even if you're not going to sit in a formal way, carry that heart of Zazen, the heart of non-anxious presence, into the world. Another thing a friend of mine does, I think she invented this. I'd love to give her credit, because I did not think of this, but I don't know that she'd be okay with me. So I'm going to call her something else. Beth. Her name is Beth, I've decided. And a long time ago, she started, she's not a Zazen person, but she's been practicing Buddhism for many years. And she decided every time she noticed that she was feeling really good, when she became aware, oh, I really feel good. I feel happy, or I feel content, or I don't have a lot of anxiety, or I notice there's a lot of food on the table, or I notice I've got friends and relatives around me. And she just became aware that she was experiencing some variation on happiness. She would go, oh, I'm aware that I'm really happy. My wish is for everybody to feel this way. My wish is for everybody to feel content, or happy, or connected to their husband, or have enough food on the table, or whatever that was. Wow. Traffic today to work was really moving. I hope everybody's commute is free from, right? She just all of a sudden realized, instead of hanging on to this as my own, I just want to turn this into a Dharma practice. I want to turn this into the idea that this is contagious. The idea that this is contagious, that this spreads. Wow, may everybody have it. Just by reminding herself of that, she reminded herself that the stance of her heart was one, that I want this to flow through me and touch everybody. Isn't that cool? I really like that she did that. So I do that too. I do that too now. The other one I do sometimes when I meet people on the street is to smile if I catch their eye or if they catch my eye. Just that simple smile is very powerful currency. It isn't always appropriate, but oftentimes it is. And I've gotten in the habit of thinking silently to myself when I meet their eyes, friend. So I'm in a room right now of 57 friends. Even if I have a history with you and you are a pain, if I start an interaction by just meeting your eyes and thinking to myself, friend, all I'm really doing is practicing on my own heart. Don't shut it. They're a person. They want to be happy just like you. They hurt just like you. We're in this together. Right? Friend, hello, friend. So, please, sit zazen every day. Offer the world your fearlessness. You already have it, but zazen sure helps. So the final one, the last one that I will talk about today is Dhamma Dana. Dhamma is Sanskrit for, or Pali actually, I'm sorry, that's Pali. That's Pali for Dharma, the gift of Dharma. This is also kind of obvious for those of us who are Buddhist practitioners or Buddhist students think, oh yeah, the gift of Dharma, sure, that's what a Dharma talk is, that's what a Dharma book is, that's right. Yeah, that is right. but let's also not limit it. Let's not limit it to Buddhist stuff. Let's not make it Buddhist. I mean, it can be Buddhist. That's cool that it shows up that way. But Dharma is unlimited, so it's certainly not limited to Buddhism, and it's certainly not limited to humans. I like to remind myself of that a lot. So we can welcome in the gift. We can receive, put ourselves in a position of receptivity to other dharmas, the helpful and supportive teachings of compassion and wisdom, wherever they come from, friends, relatives, bumper stickers, sacred texts, cloud formations, TV shows, doesn't matter. It's a position of the heart to receive the Dharma. And sometimes it's obvious, it really is listening to a Dharma talk. Maybe you're studying the Heart Sutra or the Metta Sutra, a great gift of Dharma. And we live in a great age for this because these days with the internet, you can go on the internet and just Google Dharma talk and you're set for the rest of your life. Seriously, you could put on one talk that would go into another one and you really could listen to nonstop Dharma talks easily the rest of your life. And books on Dharma, there's never been so many. So there's so much out there. And, you know, feed yourself in that way. It's very, very helpful. But even if you don't feed yourself that way, and even if you don't think of yourself as a Buddhist, that's fine. Because true Dharma is really just regarding all the contents of each moment with care. That's really all it is. Dharma is really no separation. And no separation just means no you. It also means no not you. Dharma just means we miss our life if we put ourselves at the center of it. That's not where you are. Dharma is what we find when we put everything at the center. Then what we call our lives expands to include everything, to truly include everything. Wow. Wow. Dharma, no separation, no boundaries. So one example from my life of how I've received Dharma, although there are many, sitting zazen with you this morning. Right? I sat in this room of 30 other Buddhas. You were all offering me the gift of Dharma. There was nowhere I could look and not see Dharma. There was not a breath I could take that wasn't just inside you. I was breathing the perfect Dharma of no separation. Over and over, I couldn't not do it. The Dharma of no separation. And one idea of how you might offer others the gift of Dharma. You don't have to be a Buddhist to do this, you guys. Everybody gets to do this. But one way you can give the gift of Dharma is to tell somebody, oh, wow, I was online and I heard a great talk by Norm Fisher. I'm going to send you the link. It was really helpful for me because of da-da-da-da-da. I just got through reading Pema Chodron's book, The Places That Scare You. Wow, that was an amazing book. I know you're in a tough space right now. Maybe you could be of help. That kind of thing, right? Obvious, very easy. Send a friend to a link. Send them a link to a TED talk you heard. Send them a link to a song you like. Wear a t-shirt, right, that has a Martin Luther King quote on it that you like, or a Gandhi quote, or something from Nelson Mandela. Wow. No one can be free when others are enslaved. Oh, that's Dharma. Oh, yeah. Wow. Something about nonviolence, something about your commitment to non-harm, something about your commitment to connection, something about, right? That's a way we can embody these things. And sit zazen. Like I said this morning, when you sit zazen, you offer the whole world the gift of fearlessness. You offer the whole world the gift of Dharma. Because this is Zen, and in Zen, sitting, zazen is offering complete Dharma. I am today, by giving you a Dharma talk, offering you incomplete Dharma. I am doing the best I can up here, you guys. I am doing the very best I can. But by definition, I can't give you complete Dharma. It's not possible. But you can give it and you can receive it if you sit Sazen. Complete Dharma. It is the most venerable and only true Dharma, Sazen. Pushing us past all ideas of separation. And now I'm using lofty terms, so I'll take a step back and go, please don't get too hung up on truth with a capital T or Dharma with a capital D. Just don't get too caught by that stuff. There's actually no Dharma and there's no truth in Zazen. I mean, come on, man. You're just sitting Zazen. That's all there is. You're just sitting Zazen. That's why it is complete, right? So don't get too hung up on these things. But please do sit Zazen. Do that part. Giving a Dharma talk is a funny thing, you guys. Everything you say, the opposite is true, too. So it's just a weird thing to do. So I'm going to close with a poem that I've come to really, really love. I recently bought a copy of the Theragata. Some of you know this piece. I know just a little bit. The book I have, the translation, is called First Buddhist Women. And, geez, had I known I was going to say this, I wish I would have written down the name of the... Does anybody happen to know off the top of their head? Yes, Susan Murcott, is that right? Thank you, Susan. You Susans, they have a connection, right? Susan Murcott, I think, is the one who translated this. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous book. It's a collection of stories and poetry from the first followers of the historical Buddha. So these stories and poems are, roughly speaking, 2,500 years old. Beautiful, beautiful. It really is. It's a gorgeous text. But one poem that really stood out to me was by a nun named Sumana. She was one of the first nuns of the Buddha because she lived during his life and saw him give talks. And she heard him offer this, the story goes, she heard him offer this poem during a talk, and she had an enlightenment experience, an experience of non-separation. She just woke up. She was quite old at that point, according to the story. And that was the thing that pierced her. It was the thing that pierced her, and so it became hers. It became hers. She would then offer it as teaching. She would then work with it, right? This became her poem, which is really beautiful. So it's four lines. Lie down, old woman, in the robe you made. Your desire is still. You are quenched and cool. Lie down, old woman, in the robe you made. Your desire is still. You are quenched and cool. Isn't that cool? I just love the simplicity of it. So she's received the material gift of a robe. She made it. That's our tradition. But she's got the material gift she's wearing. She has received and is continuing to offer the gift of fearlessness. Her desire is still. Her desire is still. You know, when you don't desire anything, you're not scared of anything. Does that make sense, the relationship there? Without fear, there is no hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. You are quenched and cool. That's what the Dharma does. It cools. To cool by blowing. Right? Our fires, our fires of desire, our fires of fear, our fires of anger, our fires of hate, our fires of delusion, our fires of greed, we know this. This is the stuff that hurts. And she's experienced freedom from those things through the three gifts. You are quenched and cool. So when we sit Zazen, and this isn't just for Buddhist nuns 2,500 years ago, folks. This is for all of us right here, right now. Even if this is the very first time you've ever walked in this building, Zazen is very, very simple. And when we offer ourselves the gift of Zazen, we are giver, receiver, and gift, as we say in our meal chants. As Katagiri Roshi used to say, Zazen is giving yourself to yourself. So there, you're the material, you're the fearlessness, you're the Dharma, and you're the one receiving material, the fearlessness and the Dharma. And when we sit zazen, when we give ourselves to this simple practice, after a while, our heart begins to open, our mind begins to still, our emotions begin to calm. And finally, we are the way we always have been, open and soft. We're just open and soft, and we remember something that some part of us has always known, but something that's really important. And that's that we depend on the world. We completely depend on the world. In every instant of our lives, we depend utterly on the entire world. And the world depends utterly on us. The world depends on you. We need its help, and it needs ours. We have to receive what is offered to us, and we have to give what we can. And what's interesting about this idea is all we're doing is making what already is a choice. Because you actually don't have a choice. You're already receiving from the world constantly. You couldn't take another breath if you weren't receiving it from outside of you, right? And you're always giving. You can't not give. It's impossible. We are interdependent, right? Your posture shows it. Your breath shows it. Your thoughts, your emotion, your actions, everything shows it. You have no choice but to be constantly receiving and constantly giving. But when we're aware of it, now it's on our radar. Now we're aware. Now I can make choices about what I want to give. I can make choices about what I take in and what I do with that. What do I do with the anger that's just been offered to me? Do I want to give it back out again as anger? I have a choice. Now I have a choice. That's what our zazen is for. When we stay open to our lives, we can be of more help. When we're more open to our lives, we can be of more help. We can taste fearlessness in ourselves, in our own experience. We can then offer it. We can also taste joy, even when our eyes are filled with tears because we read the morning headlines. We see the great suffering all around us. We see our joy can include that. Our joy can help transmute that. Our joy can be part of what we offer as an antidote to that. Because we're not separate from it. We're not separate from it. We're not separate from that great suffering. And that non-separation can bring us huge joy. The joy of connection. The joy of reality showing up really as it is. There's something really beautiful about this. It's very challenging, but it's also very simple. And that's the invitation. That's the invitation is in practice. Because we are all together. After all, in the end, it's about all of us. So, let's give. Let's give completely. Let's receive completely. Let's keep practicing together forever. How about that? All right, I ended on time. Thank you very much. So I know we have a little bit of extra time we need today because of the announcements and because this is Joyce Food Shelf Sunday, but we have just a minute or two. So, thank you, Peter. I would love to. So the poem, again, is from a book called First Buddhist Women by Susan Walcott. Did I get that right? Murcott. Susan Murcott. If you Google it, you'll find it, you guys. Google's way smarter than I am. But it's the Theragata. It's a translation of the Theragata, and this poem is from Sumana. And I would tell you the page number if it was on, if I knew. Sumana. Lie down, old woman, in the robe you made. Your desire is still. You are quenched and cool. There's such a sense of arriving in that, isn't there? There's such a sense of arriving at a place we all want to go. So, please.
When I read the poem, it reminds me of the robe that she made with the life that she created.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes any sense.
Absolutely it does. Absolutely it does, yeah. Yeah, in a literal sense, the tradition is she would have actually sewn her own robe. But in a much less literal sense, yeah, the robe is the field far beyond form and emptiness. It would include, of course, all of her experiences. And especially in this type of Buddhism, that would have included all of her karma. So like you say, her whole life, all the choices that she made, all the pains that she felt. It certainly would be her practice, because she's at rest now. Like, I get to lie down in this, you know. And of course, she's literally wrapped in cloth, but in a larger Dharma sense, she's wrapped in every decision she made, every person she's related to, everything that took her to this moment of non-separation. And obviously her practices, you know, especially from a traditional Buddhist point of view, what allows her to feel that quenched, cool, arrived sense is that she's sat every day. She's worked with the mind. She's transformed her fear. She's gotten free. Yeah, very much that. Yeah. Could you guys hear that back there? Did that make sense? She's wrapped in her whole life. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that a cool way of looking at it?
Alternatively, in a more macabre way.
Let's not get too lofty here.
It might be a shroud. It might be that she's cooled off because she's no longer there.
Yeah. And wow, you're feeding me some good stuff here. Thank you. Because again, in the tradition, they sewed their robes from found cloth, what Dogen would have called pure cloth, meaning it has no value to anybody else. It has been discarded. So generally, you find that cloth on burial pyres, on funeral pyres. So you'd find your cloth from the gutter, the ditch, the funeral pyres, whatever that would be. Yeah, there's definitely a sense of... And of course, again, in the early Buddhist tradition, the idea of being done, like enlightened, means I'm never coming back again. I will not be reborn into this world of suffering. So it really is an end of sorts, an end of karmic... the karmic chain, you know, she's finally free. In a Mahayana point of view, because we emphasize the Bodhisattva ideal a little bit higher than we do the Arhat idea, I like to think she's just taken a break because her project is nowhere near done. She's a Bodhisattva, and she's going to come back over and over and over. And, you know, now that I'm in my head, of course her project's done. It's done because it's done. It's never not done. It's just not done. Yeah, never mind. That's the problem, you guys. Don't ever sit on this seat. It's the most dangerous thing you can ever do. And I noticed them. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.